Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I'm an SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Justin Meinhardt joins me at Talkcast every Thursday starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444, just follow the directions, and the call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web, just go to the TalkShoe website at www.talkshoe.com and search for quality 17702, or you can also look for SFU On Call or Starfleet Universe On Call, and then you should find us there then. And, of course, if you want the best online experience, you want to go to twitch.tv, yes, twitch.tv/SFU On Call, and you can join us there. You can join the chat room and be there and join with all the chatters and listen to and my beautiful voice and watch my wonderful features, which I'm just glad I don't break the camera. And of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, while it still exists, the account there is sfuoncall. And of course, my other account is Paul Franz there. Without the Z, that's PAUFRANZ, no T. And also Franz Games, FRANZ, GMES. And of course, without the, there is no T. Of course, a lovely Talkcast gets turned to podcasts available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from A to B this week. And I do mean really quick. The good news that there is, they have map panels now, have come in for Federation Command and Core sets. And of course, the graduation are now available. So are the deluxe battle maps. But there is some bad news. The bad news is that the prices to A to B have tripled. And, you know, A to B has done their best to hold the line when it comes to the core sets, but everything had to go up in price, so that is the breaks. Moving onward to the Sapphire Star 14 tournament of the first round games, we have two of them are completed. So we have two out of the eight games are completed. I've yet to play my game. My game is going to be played tomorrow night. That's Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. So you want to watch me play, feel free to stop in and watch me. I'm playing against John Malice. I'm not sure how much he's played. I've never seen him play in a tournament before. So it should be either it's going to be a really good game or I'm going to kick his butt. Can't tell. I have a hard time believing that he's going to kick my butt that quickly. Just because, as I said, I have not seen him in a tournament before. Onward and forward, when it comes to online client stuff, nothing happening there this week. I probably will be doing some work later on this week, possibly this weekend. I might get something done on the client or sometime on something work on the server. Not sure where I'll be placing my efforts this weekend. When it comes to library report, nothing has happened this week. I have yet to get around to processing the updated SSDs, both in the SAP and FedCom libraries. I will get around to them at some point. I don't know time-wise where that whole thing is. In my copious spare time. Yeah, very copious. Yeah, right. And with that is the news for this week. And it's me, SF Online, Paul Lawrence, welcoming you. That's you. The Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we have Jeff.
Good evening, everyone.
How are you doing? Lovely night.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Yeah, it's a little chilly in this area. In Pennsylvania, it's like fall.
It's a comfortable break from the temperature here. Of course, I'm in Kansas tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been having temperatures in like in the 80s. And today was like high and like maybe 70. So a little chilly for a summer's day. So it is what it is. And we have, of course, Doug. How you doing, Doug?
Hello, I'm here. How are you doing?
Good, good. Staying out of trouble?
Sure. Yes.
That does not surprise me.
Yep.
What?
Crazy week.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy, crazy week. Otherwise, everything's normalish.
There. Okay. So I had to just twitch and keep an eye on it over there. And Chris Newsy is there. Hey, how you doing, Chris? And we have a couple topics for this evening. I wanted to start off with a really quick one, and it's going to be just pretty quick. This idea is quick. Whether it actually is quick or not, we'll just have to wait and see. But
well, quick for us is kind of a
relative term.
Things. Yes.
Understood. But, okay, there. The first topic for this evening, I just want to go quick tactics discussion of the Klingon versus the Andromedan, because that's going to be my matchup next, no, not next week, is tomorrow. I'm going to be flying against John Malice, and hopefully I will do a good job, because it might be a really tough battle for all I know. But, of course, the one thing, and I know people have heard me complain about before, which, of course, is the Klingons UIM, which is, they've got the UIM, which is not doesn't break down, which, in my mind, is completely and totally unfair. But not sure I can do anything about that. Yeah, it's not like my whining is actually going to do anything.
I don't know. You could turn her off.
It'll make you feel better.
Yeah. I was just thinking, the thing is that you've got the one T-bomb to deal with the scatter pack if necessary. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect of it is that if you actually manage to get to, if he lets you get to range two, you can batter a shield down and do a phaser dump on him. And he can only really deal with that twice. And the thing is, if you play your cards right and you get your escape maneuver in good, he can't really hurt you enough in return.
True, on the at least on the first battle pass, you know.
So this might be the time to go fairly aggressive and try to overhaul it.
Mm-hmm.
And with standard drones, just doing 12 points of damage.
Yep.
You could theoretically wade through two or even three of them if you needed to, in order to get to a better firing position if you didn't do it all at the same time.
True. Now, here's always there's always some nice things that could happen, and this all depends on, of course, the Klingon being willing to help me along the way.
I was just thinking to myself, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. I think I know the advice Patrick would offer. He says, "Oh yeah, you're fighting a Klingon on the first round. Tell you what, self destruct."
I don't think that's a winning strategy.
No, just charge straight at him. Charge right into his guns. It'll be okay.
Unfortunately, that's kind of what I said. Although I was being a little more nuanced about it, and I wasn't actually trying to get you to lose. The proof in the pudding will be how your opponent manages to split the difference between managing the drones, managing their speed and power, and what they do with their scatter pack.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Agreed. And how, and here's also a very critical portion of this, which is how does the Klingon deploy their scatter pack? There's multiple ways of actually deploying it. One is, of course, is as soon as the game starts, boom, deploy it and get the drones out there as fast as possible. Now, if he does that, then obviously that limits him to what he can do if he wants to launch any drones. He would have to actually drop some tracking on some of the scatter pack drones, because remember, this is a Klingon, not the Zinni.
Right. Well, the thing is that one of the fun things that I used to see done every now and then, and I even thought about doing it once, but I never actually got around to doing it, and that is hold your scatter pack on turn one and use deck crew actions to take two drones out of your scatter pack, and then launch your scatter pack on turn two and blast them with four drones. You're going to turn around and you're going to cause a lot of blue language to your opponent, who's going to kind of figure out is that two type four drones in that scatter pack or not? You don't know until you get close and you throw the labs on them.
Right. Oh, agreed.
And the thing is the best part about it is that since you've only got six drone channels to begin with, if you've only got four drones on the map, you've got room to launch more.
Yes, you do. Which is the beauty of that strategy. Of course, that strategy also has its downfall, which is either you have to go through the first battle pass without the drones from the scatter pack.
Right.
Which is fine. Because most probably,
it's a trade-off.
Unless you do a corner dodge, you're gonna be facing your opponent, you know, without your scatter pack being launched.
That's true. The other side of the equation on that one, and it is a very cynical view. It's not a tactic that I think has a lot of merit. If you've got two drones sticking around in your unloaded space, they don't actually attach to any one SSD box, which means that after you've taken a drone rack hit, you could, in theory, CDR reload. Reload it.
Yep.
It's one of the two ships in the game that can actually do that. The other being the Zanti.
Mm-hmm. Actually, in theory, if you wanted to, I mean, really had forethought in this. In theory, any ship that has a drone rack can just not use that drone rack and unload it.
True.
Yeah, you know, and have that in storage. And as a precursor, knowing that you're going to lose a drone rack. Now, have I ever seen anyone do that? No. Never seen anyone do that.
The remnants
of the old...
Yeah, it's more
important to have your drones out in the road.
Oh, yeah, it is.
That is true.
And the thing is also you're running into something else, as the old original tournament rules gave you a maximum of 3 hours for the preliminary rounds. You don't have the time to turn around and play some kind of 20-turn ballet to get your opponent in position where such grasping at the dandelion roots tactics are viable.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah, the question is, how subtle do you think he's going to try to be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I think he's going to unload the drones? No, I don't think he's going to do that. That's, you know, as you pointed out, Jeff, you know, I think that is a low probability strategy just because of no one ever does it. Now the question then comes.
Now watch him do it anyway.
Yeah. Now comes in. There's the other tactic when it comes to the scatter pack. Actually, there's basically three kind of tactics overall. Jeff's kind of the fourth, but that's a minor twist. You want the drones in front of your ship, so you're leading them. So in other words, the drones will, you act as mobile terrain, as drones really are, as by definition they currently kind of are. That's my most secret weapon. So it's not meant to inflict any damage on people. Just the threat of actually it doing the damage on people that forces them to move, and therefore the whole idea of mobile terrain.
Right.
Now, the other one is to have it so it's a lead up. It's, you know, you're leading your drones into combat. So the idea is that your opponent then is going to hold back on some of its phasers so he has something defensive to fire down the phasers afterwards. So, you know, that's another tactic, which, of course, can be really scary for the opponent, because the opponent then has to make sure that those phasers don't get blown off the ship. You know,
yep.
You got to take some internals.
And of course, it's always the trade-off. What are you willing to risk for what payoff?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, of course, then there's the third, which is the drones are completely independent of the ship. I.e., what you do is you launch the scatter pack, and what it becomes is a roaming nuclear space mine. It waits for a certain range, let's say like range 5, and as soon as the target becomes within range, let's say 5, the drones then launch. Or if you want to be 10. If you're concerned about it being blown away, you know, the drones being destroyed before they're actually able to launch, then I would say, you know, you might want, instead of 5, you might 8. You know, it might have launched at range 8. Obviously, 5 is kind of better to a certain degree.
If you're going to do that, I might turn around, and if it were me, I might turn around and launch a pseudo suicide shuttle, Warhead Zero suicide shuttle.
Yep.
Ballistically targeted on a hex.
Mm-hmm.
And two or three impulses later, launch the scatter pack ballistically targeted for a different hex. And when they get to that hex, they just stop, because that's their programming. And those are two valid order sets under the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And it would at that point be effectively a captor mine like you talk about.
Right.
The downside to that is that you can't run to the far corner of the map, because if you're not within 35 hexes of your seeking weapons, you can't control them.
Correct. And you can't do well against Andromeda. You don't have the issue with wild weasels. So
yeah. So yeah, the only thing it costs you is it doesn't even cost you anything, because a Warhead Zero suicide shuttle can be launched with zero preparation.
Yeah.
You just basically program the computer and launch it without doing anything for a warhead. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I used one of those myself in my last fight with the last Sapphire tournament against Peter. I was trying to encourage him to turn away and not follow me.
Mm-hmm.
It worked. I got away.
Yeah, hey.
Not for all that it, for all the good it did me. He got me a couple turns later.
Yep. Yeah, but as you pointed out, that in that case that maneuver is good for an escape round. The idea of that. You know, have it so that if your opponent doesn't have that many weapons available to them, launching it as kind of a deterrent, have it so that at the very least they adjust where they're moving.
Yep.
You know, that'd be a good strategy in that case. Now, earlier on, it makes no sense because of, one, it's, you know, as you said, it requires no preparation time, and therefore, mm-hmm. you know, it's better to keep the shuttle in the bay, available for, you know, knife fighting.
That's it. That's the other side of it. Is that if you're gonna, you know, it's like here, it's again the trade-off. If the shuttle's in the bay and the bay gets hit, you lose the shuttle. right?
Right, but of course, to get to the shuttle bay, it takes a lot of damage to get there.
That's true. It does. It's a lot easier. It's a lot easier to knock a phaser or two out than it is to hit it.
Here's the thing. You're running an Andromeda, and you knock one of his shields down. Just say, "Oh, okay, I take hit and run rate at each of your shuttle bays. Are they guarded? No. Bam, bam, bam. You know.
That's true.
Well, okay, there is that.
Get the one that has.
Yeah, and I'd have to.
Yeah, it's like this. I wouldn't stress too much over over that particular shuttle, because as the Andromedan, you've got severe maneuverability on your side. Even though you maybe have the same turn motives, and I forget if you do or not.
Yeah, I do.
He does.
You've got the power to outrun his drones if he gets the wave out there. If he launches the thing and you think that's it, just kill it before it launches. You know, you've got time on your side slightly when it comes to like his drones.
Mm-hmm.
If he launches them and you kill the thing, they're gone. If he doesn't launch them, then they're worthless to him. They're just something you're overstressing about.
Oh, okay. I
think you probably really want to just get one shield down of his, so you can just Mitzia away with your TRs and save, you know, maybe save your phasers in case he launches a good drone wave.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And of course,
if you can get them near the wall with your power, just, you know, track them and slam his ass in the wall and keep going. I'm just saying, these are just some thoughts.
Yeah, well, when it comes to tractoring him, that means after you
make him play your game.
Right.
You know, instead of like, man, what am I going to do if he does this? Just kill it. If he launches a drone thing, just kill it.
Oh, I understand.
You know, reach out at range 3 with that with a tractor and just go hide.
Yep.
And you lose the use of the TR beam to do that.
Correct.
But the thing is that.
But you kill a significant chunk of his firepower in one shot.
But by committing one of your TR beams to that, provided you've loaded it as a heavy TR beam, that's 6 points of effective. That's 6 points of power in the tractor without even committing batteries. And that's going to be hard for anybody to bounce, even at range 3, if they don't have the power.
Mm-hmm.
True. And when it comes to this, you know, the Scott Pack, it's going to be reactionary as it is. And the one thing that always makes things more difficult, not impossible, just makes things difficult, which is when people, because I have the T-bomb, and they know I have the T-bomb. Therefore, they're not going to just, when they launch from a scatter pack, if they can do it, depends upon where I am as relation to the scatter pack, and that is they can have their drones go off in two or possibly three directions when they launch from the scatter pack. So they're not just one big stack.
And don't forget that the T-bomb has its own issues. As the Andromedan, you must transport the bomb, and that means after it materializes, it's got
no, you can
how
drop
many
it. You
impulses
can...
before it can detonate?
Two.
Right? So you have to be careful of that.
Yeah. Well, you can drop it out the hatch, but there's...
No, I don't think you can.
Yes, you can.
I thought the Andromeda was limited to transport operations only.
Nope.
And it was the Romulan that was limited to dropping it off the hatch.
Nope. The Andromeda is allowed to drop it off the hatch. But, of course, it's also a lot more difficult to deploy because you have to get out of the blast radius before it's actually activated.
Yeah.
Which is minimum, two impulses. But the one thing that you can do is have it so that if you drop it out the hatch, is it can be dropped into the same hex as the Andromedan, so as a ship.
That's true. You could do that. The other good thing about dropping the T-bomb out of the hatch is if the scatter pack has burst and they've settled into a stern chase, and they're far enough back that you can move twice before they get within range.
Mm-hmm. And depending upon drones and so forth, and if mm-hmm. the big thing when it comes to drones in front of a ship when you're coming in, that just means you have to make sure that your speed is at least speed 24 or greater to so that you can go around the drones.
Are you sure about 24?
Yeah. It depends where you are in the impulse chart. It really
That's
does.
True.
You can get away That's with true. 24, but it has to be a certain number of hexes.
Well, yeah, the range between the drones and the what range between you and the drones matters almost as much, if not more.
Correct. Well, exactly. You don't want to go from 2 to 0.
No.
Oh, idea in that case is to be able to side slip, if yeah. possible. You really want to have it so that range one, you've come into range one of them. Next impulse, they don't move, but you do move, so you can side slip past them, and keep going.
Right.
Because there's only when they move next, they have two shots. They have two possible moves. One, hit, which means they don't actually go forward.
Yeah, they don't actually move. Right.
Or the other one is turn and come in behind me. That's the two options.
And they can only do that as if by turning they can keep you in their FA arc.
Right. Actually, in theory, it doesn't have to be FA. It can be FX.
If I'm remembering correctly, you have to maneuver the drone so that if you can maneuver the drone in such a fashion that it stays in the FA, mm-hmm. you must do that.
Yes.
If you cannot do that and you can maneuver the drone to keep it in the FX, you're allowed to do that only if the first condition cannot be met.
Correct. That is
so you can't
correct.
Elect to leave it in the FX if you could put it in the FA.
That is correct. You got that. That's right. So
sorry for being pedantic.
Oh no. That's exactly what I was thinking though, because that means if I'm moving the next impulse, that they're going to come in behind me. They're still in the FX arc, but they're not in the FA arc.
Which means they have to turn if they can't.
Well, that's it. That's if they're turning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd have to look at it. But I was under the impression that even if you're on the next impulse, impulse five, say, the drone's in, you're in the drone's FX arc, but not in its FA. On the next turn, it moves. The next impulse, it moves. It has to turn in order to try to put you in the FA. That's part of the drone rules, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Yeah, and the thing is, and the drones have, it's not like they can sit still. They have to move.
And matter of fact, there's rules limiting when they can hit, because otherwise they could turn around and hit just to space themselves out from the scatter pack.
Right. Exactly. And you, just like you can't do it.
But again, his problem is he has a very limited amount of drones.
That's true.
Compared to like a Kazini or something. And once you've dealt with them, you can just dance around them and beat it.
The D7T just has the two drone racks and the scatter pack, right?
Right. And of course, then we still have the ad rack.
He's got an ADD rack, and does he have two Type 6s in it too?
Yep.
Okay. So in theory, he could. If he launches something out of every rack every turn, if you make it to turn seven, it's all there is to it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and so that's always the gotcha with the Klingon, which is you have to be cognizant that he does have fast drones.
He's got up to four fast drones?
Correct. And invariably, two of those are type 4s.
It doesn't make sense not for them not to be.
Yeah. Agreed.
Unless, hey, wait a minute.
Actually, I think it only gets one. I have to double check on the number of type fours you can have. How many times you can swap out?
Two for everybody but the Zenti. The Zenti gets three.
Right. Okay. That,
if you got if you got drone racks, you can swap up to two, up to twice.
That's what I thought. That's what I thought. But from up there, I thought that sounded a little bit high, you know, on the swaps. But
well, I was just thinking, you know, he's got the two Type 6 drones. If you made both of them, if you were, this is, sorry, I'm spitballing here, but this mm-hmm. is, if you were, say, up against the Hydran and you upgraded both of your Type 6s to fast, would that cost you 1 point or half a point?
It costs you 1 point.
Oh, okay.
That's why people normally do the swap and then pay for getting them fast.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's the way that would work. I was just curious if the Type 6 is upgraded at half price like they do in the standard game.
Hey, hello, little Zinti.
I wondered when we'd get, when the hit and run raid would occur.
Yes, you. Okay, you gotta go. Go see me, Ma. But yeah, so again, the gods with the Klingon is that he can fire at range 8 and go, bang, I hit you. Of course, I've actually had one Klingon I faced be very unlucky and miss like with 50% of his disruptors, even with the UIM.
Well, here's the thing, Paul. Until you have to, leave your panels at regular levels.
Oh, of course.
Even if he turns around and he throws a Yahtzee with his disruptors at range 8, he's only gonna, even if he overloads, he's only doing 24 points.
Hmm? Yeah. Oh, yeah. And if I can do it right and have the possibility, I have to really think about this at the start of the game, which is start the game with my rear panels down, because what that means is that, assuming he doesn't do too much damage to the front panels, and that's a big, big assumption there, I can do a panel dump. Now, the problem is, of course, I don't have that many batteries. I got 3 batteries. So panel dumps are...
How does leaving your after panels down help you?
Okay. Because that's how you do a panel dump. If you time it right, if you have it so that basically you change it.
Yeah, I understand how flipping panels works. I'm trying to figure out why you'd want to start the match with your after panels down. It doesn't strike me as giving you any benefit whatsoever.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I know this. Given the batteries of the crate, this might not make sense. But when you do a swapping of the panels, what if assuming that you, in the case of the front panels, you don't have more than 15 points of power in the panels and you have your batteries drained.
Right.
You can turn off your front panels and turn on your back panels, and all the energy that's in your front panels goes into the batteries and not the back panels, because of the sequence of play for things. It actually,
right.
The energy goes directly into your batteries. But in that point, if you time it right, you can have it so that you go from the front panels facing your opponent, then you have your rear panels facing your opponent, which are, at that moment in time, are down. But before they get to the fire phase, they're up again. But all the power that was in your front panels is now in the batteries, and you still aren't unprotected.
Okay, that answers the question. It just seems a little tortured to me.
Yeah.
Besides, the thing is that the better way to flip your panels has nothing, doesn't leave you that vulnerable.
But
what you'd end up doing, what most of the time you end up doing is you drop from reinforced to standard levels and release power that way.
Oh, agreed. But that's you have to do that because then you don't have any choice.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that currently most of the time when it comes to Andromedan, especially in the tournament, it has, usually the panels get filled up to the degree where you need to drop them from reinforced down to standard. But at that point, if assuming that your rear shields are up, and there's your power is just going to be transferred to the rear shields. But if your front panels are up and you're facing your opponent and you drop from reinforced to standard, now your opponent has got you stuck. If they fire at you, they'll get internals.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at.
And
I never ordered it in my mind the way you've done it. And that's why I was scratching mm-hmm. my head going, okay, all right, you're going to, there might be a psychological benefit of going into battle with your after panels down, just so that you're waving your after panels at somebody the way a white-tailed deer waves its tail at the hunter as it's bounding away.
Understood.
And yes, if anybody who's ever been whitetail hunting knows exactly what that deer is telling you with that nonverbal body language. And I'm not going to reiterate on what should be a family friendly podcast.
Thank you.
But yeah, that's an interesting thought. The other side of the equation is that if he hits you with all four overloaded disruptors at range 8,
mm-hmm.
and he does this 24 points of damage, that's how many points of that's how many leak points?
That's just one leak point.
Right.
So he gets 23 points of damage against the shields, against the panels, sorry, 23.
If you keep waiting in and he doesn't veer off after unloading his disruptors at range 8, if you make it to range 5, you've got a reasonable chance of doing significant damage with your two TRs.
Agreed.
If you can make it to range 3, then not only are you going to do excellent damage with your TRs, you're going to do appreciable damage with your phaser sweep.
Agreed.
And at that point, even with all the phasers the Klingon can throw at you, can they reasonably average more than 30 points with just the phaser secondaries at range 5? I don't think they can.
You mean the Klingons?
Yeah.
Assuming that range 5 is not on the oblique.
Yeah, that's maneuver. That's a maneuver question. I'll grant you that. You would want to try to put them on your center line, and they would want to try to put you on their where they're most of their phasers bear.
Right.
I understand that. But what I'm saying is that even if you manage to catch the absolute worst positioning at range 5, could they theoretically, assuming an average roll of 3, 4, 3, 4, 3, 4 on all the dice, could they do about more than 30 points of damage? Because if they can on your first battle pass, they can't really do much more than leak damage, even with their secondaries, which means that by the time the drones catch up to you, as long as you don't have a disdev breakdown, you can position yourself basically wherever you want, and then you can go lick your wounds and try to manage your power for the next two turns until you've got heavy weapons again,
which is
trying to figure out what's going to happen.
Which is always the difficult part, which is, I have 2-turn arming weapon, and he has a 1-turn arming weapon.
But the thing is that after you commit to a close battle pass, your panels are going to be glowing hot anyway. Even if you don't do anything more than leaky point damage, you're going to need you're going to need a whole turn just to turn around and mitigate the power in your panels.
Yeah, possibly two.
On top of that, I'm not looking at the charts, but range five, the TRs can probably do, what would it be? About 20 points between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then six phaser, granted the coup de grace shot, six phaser twos at range five are probably going to average another 10 or 15 points. Right.
Mm-hmm.
If you get good die rolls, it's only gravy, but the chances are really good on that first battle pass. You're going to drop his shield because he's going to be moving fast enough. He's not going to have the power to brick. And if he's moving slow enough to have the power to brick, it doesn't mean you have to engage that turn.
True.
All I'm saying is, and this is the same point I made with your Battle Force 550 article way back,
mm-hmm.
with your huge stack of satellite ships, is that as fragile as the interior of the Andromedans are, getting to that fragile interior is not as easy as that fragile interior implies.
Oh, agreed. And without that, the Andromedans would be dead really quick.
Right. On a turn one battle pass, if he charges at you and you charge at him, he will take more strategic damage from that battle pass than you will, provided you don't end up eating all of his drones at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the thing. Your enemy's job is not to give you problems, but to give you dilemmas.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get wrapped up around the axle worrying about the disruptors or worrying about the phaser suite or worrying about the drones, he's successfully given you a dilemma.
Yeah.
What I'm telling you is that if he waits to throw the disruptors until you're already in reinforced panels, he's giving away some initiative. If you're running standard panels and you get to range five, and that's when he decides to alpha strike you. You can always use reserve power to jump from standard to reinforced, just like he can use reserve power to brick points away. The thing is that if he lets you get to range five and gives you a good firing solution, the dice will be the great equalizer, but probability is that you will do more damage than he will. And you will, more than likely, if you don't knock the shield down completely, you'll make it so weak that on your next battle pass, he's going to have to maneuver differently, not to point a weak shield at you.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get it done on one battle pass, but you can get it done on two if you're careful.
Right.
And the thing is that since you've got a two-turn arming sequence, you've got a built-in excuse to run for the other side of the map, keep the distance open, and do whatever it takes to manage your power. Heck, if he's decided to chase you all that hard, I don't know that on turn two, say, I would even bother arming the TRs at all. I would just put everything into movement to get the heck out of Dodge. Because if he's going to arm his disruptors at all, he can't go 3-1.
True. I'm not as worried about the weapons per se. I'm more worried about what is going to be my position after the first battle pass.
Yeah.
Which I think is the more important thing, because most beginner players don't think about what happens after you fire your weapons.
Yep.
And that is always my first thing. And after that, how do I get rid of all the energy that's in my panels?
Well, the thing is that after you've committed to, after you've finished the first battle pass, once you've turned off and you have put him astern on your panels, if after panels are at standard levels,
mm-hmm.
if you drop from full reinforced to full standard panels on the front, minus a point here, minus a couple of points for degradation, you're going to release, what is it, 18 points? Isn't that what it works out to? About 18 points of power if you had full panels.
Right.
And even let's just take the degradation out of it, because that would end up working in your favor. It, with full panels dropping down to reinforced, you're going to release
18.
Yeah.
18 points of power.
18 points of power. That's standard load amp on your after panels. That actually works in your favor, because then you can turn around and you'll be able to float 10 points of power.
Sorry, it's not 18, it's 24. 24.
24. Right. Still, it still works in your favor, because that doesn't overload your standard levels. It meets them, but it doesn't overload them.
Right.
And at that point, you'll be able to float 10 points of power off into space, and then rather than just 6.
Oh, yeah. Oh, agreed. That's exactly what I usually do, is that if, you know, just so that I can dissipate more energy and overall, and sometimes even take more energy into my batteries than, you know, because of the whole rounding thing goes in my favor.
Just remember that the way the rules are written, when you're pulling power from your panels, you're not allowed to pull power from your front panels to your batteries and then from your after panels to your batteries. But I don't think it really makes much difference, because at best it would only grant you an additional point of power if with a rounding error. But the thing is that, can't you pull, what is it, 20%?
You can dissipate.
You can dissipate 1 point of power per individual panel out into space. And then I think it's another, it's either 10 or 20% of your,
it's 10%.
10% of what's left can go into the batteries.
Right.
So that's 6 points from the front. That's up to 6 points from the front panels. That's up to 10 points of power every turn you can pull off the panels, put in the batteries,
mm-hmm.
based on how much power you've got in the panels as it is.
Right.
So, and the thing is, granted, it's all the way around rather than concentrated. But the thing is that means that you could, in theory, with just a single battle pass under your belt, float 10 points of power off into space, pull two or three from the panels, put back in the batteries if you've got the room for them, and you've already done 6 turns worth of damage control and shields compared to any other galactic. That's the real reason why the Andromedans aren't allowed to have 4 and 5 batteries, because even with the limitations put on them, they can flop the power around if they're careful about it.
Right. Oh, agreed. But because they only have 3 batteries, they have to work much harder to do it, because they can't do the panel dumps.
Not directly.
The panel dumps take 2 turns. You first have to get the power down to a level where it's the amount of energy that goes into the batteries is less than 15. Or 15 or less. And you have to, you have to be darn careful, because you can run into a situation where your batteries are so low, you can't put your panels from standard to reinforced levels.
Here's the thing on that, and this is one of them sneaky little things that I learned a long time ago. Andromedans can't throw power away by changing things. If you allocate for reinforced panels, on the first impulse, you can use the shield interaction stage to lower them back to standard. You don't lose the power, and you don't have to pay it again for the rest of the turn.
Oh, yeah. Oh, agreed. Oh, understood.
It's just like when you're playing with electronic warfare. The Andromedans can at best spend 12 points of power every turn on electronic warfare. Mm-hmm. They can change it as much as they want within the limits of changing things around. But once the power is paid for, they still have the effect for the remainder of the turn.
Yep. Agreed. Oh, agreed. But the thing is, you have to have the power there to begin with.
If you've got it, you've got it. That's right.
Right. And you have, and the thing is, to put it into reinforced levels, you have to have it so that you have it at reinforced level, you have to actually change it to reinforced levels. You can't just allocate it and not change from standard to reinforce levels. And when you do that, then of course you are also when you do that, then you also have to wait for a certain period of time, you know, in impulses before you can drop it from reinforced down to standards.
I think it's 8 impulses, just like with regular shield operations.
Yep. Oh, yep. So you always have to worry about the situation where you might want to drop a reinforced down to standard levels because of you trying to slush around some energy, and you don't want that much energy because you might want, in the case of, there's a situation I've had in the past where basically I wanted my panels at standard level so that when I drop the front panels, all that energy sloshed to the back panels, and then all the extra overflowed into the batteries. But if I had a reinforced levels, it'd just be stuck in the rear panels until I dropped the panels to standard levels. And I have to make sure that when I get to that point, that my, tactically speaking, my front panels are still not facing the enemy. You know, the ones that are at that point down.
I understand.
So
it's one of the reasons why the number of players that can operate the Andromedans competently or proficiently are few and far between. And that's because it requires an entirely different mindset on how your defenses run.
Yep. And these are the mathematics I'm doing constantly when I'm playing the Andromedan. Which is...
Like, well, whenever in standard SFB, whenever I was playing Andromedan Squadron, our local ace, he was... it wasn't quite a Mizzia attack because he was never getting internals, but he would calculate it so where he was, he would turn around and he would add up the disruptor damage in threes,
right,
in order to accelerate the degradation points,
yep,
inside the panels. He would sandblast the panels, and then when I couldn't do anything about it, that's when he would turn in on a battle pass, which is usually when I decided to go somewhere else.
Oh, understood. Oh, see, that's the gotcha, which is, as a opponent to the Andromedan, you're not working always to get internals. You're working to degrade the panels, therefore trying to get at least 3 points of power, you know, 3 points of damage against the panels each and every time you fire a weapon. Therefore, that gets one. For 3 points of damage, you get 1 point of degradation. So that's a really, really good ratio of 1/3 of your damage is going to degradation instead of 20%, yep, which is 1 in 5.
That's, and that only works for disruptor damage. So
No. That works for all damage.
I thought there was an interaction between disruptors, yeah, and panels that made it different.
That's the leaks. That's leak points. The disruptors only require 2 points of damage per panel to leak.
Okay.
And if I call correctly, and I'd have to double check on the rule, but I'm pretty sure that you don't even have to have it so force the panels to go into reinforced levels for it to leak when you're firing a disruptor at the Andromedan panels because of the disruptive effect.
Right.
Of disruptors.
Does make you wonder why so many of the galactic powers use disruptors to one degree or another, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A good third, maybe even half of the galactic heavy weapons are disruptors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
it sounds to me like, you know, from somebody who's played Andromedans against competent galactic players, there's a reason why the Andromedans lost
Yeah.
Lost the conflict, and it was because the disruptor races walked all over them after they learned the tactics they had to use.
Nah, it's because that stupid Federation came back from the future.
Yeah, I know, but...
Oh, it's time stuff.
The thing is, we conquered you people! In the future, we conquered! And then you come back and change the Captain timeline!
Blame it all on Captain Doc Brown on the Beagle.
Gosh, you. But it's one of those the degradation things. As I said, it's annoying as heck. Now, the one good thing that the Andromedans have is that what is called the tertiary shield, which is even if the panels are full, they still give you a certain level of protection. Which is because of the degradation that it does, the damage does degradation, which then might release a point of energy from that panel. And that point of energy is released, then it goes into the other panel group. Assuming that that panel group is not full, but if it is full, then it goes in the batteries. Now, if the battery is full, then it's damage. It's internals.
Right. And the other side of it is that even completely full panels will protect you from transporters. So you can do the H&R thing, and they can't.
Yep. Gotta love it.
Yep.
Which will probably end up being a critical thing for you. You get a shield down on him, and you keep popping that, even with weak damage, to make sure his reinforcement's gone. And just throw those hit and run raids in every turn. Once he starts guarding stuff, hit other stuff.
As a matter of fact, there's things you can go after that aren't typically guarded. He's only got 12 boarding parties to guard things with. And the thing is that probably one of the cheap kills you can get is go after the impulse engines. Agreed. He's not going to guard those. And the loss of the power will still hurt.
Mm-hmm. Agree, but it's probably many guards.
How many transporters do you have on that thing? I forget. Is it two?
I think it's
more?
Two.
Two.
And that's the downside of using that is that you end up with fractional points left in the battery.
Oh, I hate that.
Which makes life really interesting when you're trying to do things.
No kidding.
The plus side about it is that unless he's filling up your batteries, you can pull fractional points out of the panels sometimes.
Yeah, you've got fractional movement too, so there's that.
Yeah, fractional movement, which is two-thirds, it's in thirds, while the transporters are in fifths.
That means if you use both transporters that you'll have 0.6 points of a power, or points, six-tenths of a point, and that's a movement point.
Not
or
quite.
Close enough.
But it's not. Because movement is 0.666666, infinitum.
Right.
Not 0.6.
The thing is at that point, the loss of generation of the remainder fraction is not going to sting like trying to loss of generation several points of power because you don't have a place to put it.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, but
then again, how much more fun would the Andromedan tournament crate be if they let you have five transporters so that the math worked out better?
Yeah. Oh my god, that would be so much more fun.
Yep,
it would. Yeah. It really would. But the thing is that you'd only get to do it for two turns because after that. All you have is two boarding parties plus the survivors of the other 10 attacks. you wouldn't necessarily be able to get more than three turns of H&R before you turn around and you'd run out of the boarding parties to work with. But the thing is that would be that might even be a viable way to offset the fact that the Andromedans don't have a seeking weapon system or a wild weasel equivalent.
Mm-hmm. Well, the T-bomb is actually a very useful weapon. Now, this is one of those things that I've done against an Orion. Usually you save the T-bomb when it comes to drones to be against the drones. But I've done this against an Orion. Well, actually, one time actually successfully, because it's really hard to do, which is using the T-bomb to modify your opponent's movement.
Yep.
Because the question is, does your opponent want to take 10 points against a shield? Sometimes I'll go, yeah, I'll take the 10 points and stay close. In some other cases, when they've already had 10 points of damage against that one shield, or the shield's down, they'll go, oh, I'll pass on that. Thank you very much.
It can work. That's true.
Right. Or even if it does not, it doesn't directly work, but it might require them to change what they do. So let's say that you have shield number two down. Well, then if they want to keep coming, they have to line it up so it's shield number one. While they're going straight, I'm side slipping. So that might give me an extra
You're talking about here is stern chase tactics. Somebody's mm-hmm. chasing you.
Yep.
And you're in a position, when you're laying a T-bomb, unless you're using transporters, it's almost always some kind of stern chase tactic. And the thing is that that's one of those things where you're not exactly on the defensive, but you've got your primary offenses pointed the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Just to ease up the mathematics on the Andromedan, finding some way for them to mitigate the mathematical oddity between transporters and movement points and such. If they had a total of five transporters,
right? Well,
that's statistically speaking, that's what, two successes a turn off the unguarded targets. What is it, a 50%, 50-50 chance if it's not guarded, and then 16% chance if it is?
I have to double-check. It's been a while since I've looked at the hit-and-run raids, the result tables.
You basically have to get a 1 if it's guarded to have a normal shot at it. Yeah. It's a 5 through 6 miss if it's guarded, I think. And if you do manage to hit on the guard thing, it actually just gives you the normal chance to have it work.
The thing is,
but you know what, it's also something that'll really put him on his toes. So
it puts more teeth into
if he's not expecting
downshield your direction. It puts more teeth in having a downshield your direction. And the thing is that we have already concluded on previous occasions that one of the things the Andromeda really does lack is crunch power. It mm-hmm. looks like they've
yeah,
got
it's
it,
a finesse ship.
But they don't really
but they
have
don't.
It.
It's a finesse ship. And that's why you really want to just kind of sort of grind down one or two shields until you can get through and just start mitzying the guy to death.
Yep.
Because if you try to go in close, you're going to get your stuff filled up, you're going to get your panels filled.
You're going to be running away from three or four turns while you're trying to mitigate the power in the panels.
But not only is he going to be running away for so many turns, when he does that, he's going to be taking long-range disruptor sniper shots that are going to do itty-bitty internals to him, and those will add up over time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you just got to hurry to get a shield down on him and start taking his weapons out. You got to kill his drones. You got to do hit and run raids. You have to hurt him every way possible. You know, and like you're saying, that T-bomb, that can make a huge difference at the right spot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed.
But you see a shuttle, you kill the shuttle. Save your phasers early on and see if he like tries to use that. And if he doesn't, maybe you'll get lucky and kill it. If you get a shield down and do some internals and do a hit and run rate against a couple of shuttle bays, just random shuttle bays, give him a 1 in 4 chance that, hey, that happens to be his proper shuttle that you want to kill. So there's that. Because he has to basically figure out which one's which, you know, 1 through 4, and you say, okay, I'm going after 2 and 4. And if it's one of those two and you kill it, that's a huge chunk of his firepower later.
Yep.
You won't know it necessarily, but, you know, every shuttle that dies.
Hold on a second. Does the chain reaction rules apply?
You'd have if it's in the...
No.
Would the chain reaction rules apply in tournament?
No.
Wouldn't matter. Because if the chain reaction rules, then you...
No, it would just be dead. It would just be dead on his record keeping.
I was just thinking if the chain reaction rules were in play, I don't think a suicide shuttle will chain react, but I think a wild weasel does. A scatter pack would react too.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a I don't recall that being a tournament rule.
Yeah, that was the question. Because that's the only way you would get any feedback right away if you hit something juicy or not, other than maybe some blue language from the other side of the map.
Mm-hmm.
You sang my scatter pack.
Yeah, that was one of those things that I would have to look up, which is H&R Rage against Shuttle Base and what that does.
Yeah. I do know that Doug's right. If you're going to hit and raid against a shuttle bay, the person whose shuttle bay you're raiding doesn't get to pick which box gets destroyed if it does get destroyed, like it would if it were any other kind of weapon damage. You have to actually point out which of the bays are targeting, and he's got to account for where all of his goodies are.
Yeah.
Yep.
Agreed.
Yeah, so you'll have like a 1 in 4 chance of actually getting to attack it. And then the first time you've done that, he's going to write down guards for everything, and you can pretty much assume that he's going to guard his shuttles if he hasn't launched that thing yet. And it's still not dead, and you just go for what you think he didn't like put guards to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go after some disruptors.
Go
after his APR.
Battery.
APR, battery, impulse engines. Those are the three that get guarded the least. And the battery, that takes out his reserve power ability, degrades it anyway.
Yeah, especially if you take one down and then they can't do a head on reserve.
Uh-huh. They've got to start contingently applying for a head, among other little things. It also means that they can at best brick 4 points of damage specifically, or 2 points by general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it adds up.
And then makes him spend power to avoid that. Yeah. If he loses the ability to pop up, you know, extra battery points for reinforcement, and he ends up spending points into general reinforcement or taking time to repair shields, that hinders him that much more. So,
yep. And I don't think, I think,
also make him even more cautious.
I think, I want to say batteries are 6 or 8 points for CDR. So it's not like he can get them back quick.
Batteries, I think, are 2.
Oh, no, they're cheap. They're cheap.
Oh, that's right. They are cheap. I'm thinking something else.
But on the other hand, it's gone for a turn.
Oh, yeah.
It's gone for 2 turns once you've killed
it. And not to mention, is it gone for 2 turns? It also comes back. It's the EA after successful repairs are completed that you get a chance to even charge it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of those little gotchas.
And that's assuming he bothers to fix it.
Right. Agreed. Because I doubt most people would actually fix it. Except for Romulans or any plasma players.
Yeah, and you can't. Yeah, that's another good UIM. Point. You could
hit and run rate that UIM.
Oh, that's true. Wow.
But the thing is, I can guarantee you that would be guarded if he remembers to guard anything.
That's if he does it the first time. So, first time you get in there, you go, I'm going after your UIM, and I'm going after one of your random shuttle bays, number 3, or whichever, Tell him, he's got to pick where are his shuttles right now. He writes that down, and you say, I'm going after number whatever. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. And then he's going to assign all his guards, and after that, you go for the ones that he's not expecting you to go after, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
So,
well, gentlemen.
It'll be interesting to hear how it turns out.
Oh, agreed. And I'm
mm-hmm.
hoping to go over it maybe next week or maybe a week after that. It all depends on how long it takes us to finish up our game. But anyway, with that, I think we will. What was supposed to be a short topic turned into the whole podcast topic.
Yeah.
Oh dear! I guess you'll just have to save the other topic for later.
Yeah, agree. Some
there you go.
You two just there's seem so upset about that. Okay. Well, anyhow, Jeff, you have a good knife.
I'll do that.
Doug. Always a pleasure to have you around. Have a good night.
Thank you.
So, obviously, we have different, multiple ideas about how to attack the Klingon in the Andromedan, and different tactics to when it comes to the scatter pack and the drones, and different tactics when it comes to defense and offense, obviously. So we'll have to wait and see how it all turned out to the end. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.